This recording is a production of Faith Builders Resource Group. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2022, held at Faith Builders on August 2 through 5.
Thank you, Jonas, for the lead-in there. That actually connects very well with what I want to spend this week thinking about with you all. He said, you know, we step into roles that others have formed before us, and I'm assuming each of you have at least taught for a few years, some of you probably longer than I have. But one of the things that I would like to kind of hopefully give you an opportunity to set your own heart on, and that is the idea of what we do each day that we call Christian education. And, you know, we moved out of the public schools in the 1950s, and there were men and women that put their hearts into that movement, and we've stepped into that role in many ways. And I think it'd be a travesty if we blindly do what we do and aren't sure what it's actually about and the brass tacks of what is truly Christian about it. So thank you, Jonas, for that introduction. That is a bit what I want to look at with you here this week. I think this feels like a little bit of an abrupt shift. This feels like the first time here for this year that I'm kind of in the classroom again, in a sense. And during the summer, I do physical labor. I bale hay and build houses and those types of things. And so it always feels like a bit of a shift to be a teacher again. And so you're going to let me sharpen my teeth back up here this week as well and get me ready for the classroom this year. So I feel the abruptness of it a bit. This year does mark a bit of a milestone for me. It is my 15th year in the classroom as a teacher, and I'm not sure if that's exciting or I've thought about it a variety of ways, but the truth is, in another way, there's a greater milestone that I feel that is in front of me, and that is something that will come next year, and that milestone is the milestone of having, Lord willing, one of my children in school. And I'm curious how many of you here have children in school. I know there's got to be a few of you. So you know what this feels like. This is new for me. And it has caused me to think about what I've given my life to, because suddenly my own offspring are going to be taking part of this and impacted by it. And so I've been asking myself questions over the last year or two as I've had my own children moving towards entering into school, the school age, what it is about this thing that we do that actually matters and that is worth its salt. And, you know, having my son move into school, do I trust this thing that we call Christian education to help form the life of Christ in his own heart and to bring redemption into his life and to equip him to live in a fallen world? Is it a trustworthy endeavor? And I've given myself to it, and I'm kind of embarrassed to say this. I think I've cared about those things before. So it's a little embarrassing to say that suddenly I care about it more when it's my own son. It ought not to be that way, but I confess that a bit. So I've been thinking about these things, and I really liked one of the things that Stephen said this morning, that one of the things we do in the classroom is that we protect kingdom interests. And I would like to dig into that a bit here over the next few sessions. I'd like to begin with showing you two little, I guess, collective pieces that I have. And I'm not necessarily a collector, but I have had interest in history over the years, and I like to hunt arrowheads. I actually sell tools to make arrowheads and some things like that. And so I do like old things. And I have two old things that I want to show you here this morning. Going too far here. And the first one is a coin here. And this is the coin where "In God We Trust" was first minted on it. And this is, of course, an American currency. I'm not sure, you know, Canadians. Is there any Canadians in here? Is there anything like this on any of your currencies? Any references to God?
God save the Queen.
Well, that's... So with American currency, the first piece of currency to have "In God We Trust" printed on it was came out of the Civil War. And a bit of an interesting story there, and you should look it up for yourself. I don't have time to tell you it in whole. But it appeared on a 2-cent piece following the Civil War. And they developed a 2-cent piece because they were short on currency. And so to avoid making as many pennies, they created a 2-cent piece. And there was sentiment to put "In God We Trust" on this new piece of currency. Interestingly enough, it had actually been submitted before the Civil War to do this, and it was rejected. There was not enough momentum to put this motto on the currency. However, the Civil War apparently built up a bit of a religious fervor. And in one of the things, from my understanding of what I've studied about it, is that there was even a bit of a sentiment that maybe the Civil War was punishment for a lack of faith and basically a lukewarmness towards religion. And so we got to get our act together and straighten this out. So there was enough momentum following the Civil War, strong push to get "In God We Trust" put on this 2-cent piece, and they went ahead and passed the legislation and went through with that. There's been plenty of controversy around it since that time. Everyone does not agree that we should have "In God We Trust" on the currency. In fact, in 1907, Theodore Roosevelt wanted to remove it from the currency, and he said, "Well, it's a sacrilege to have this on our money." And so he wanted to take it off, and there was a lot of back and forth, and they've actually tried to remove it several times, but every time that there's been an attempt to remove "In God We Trust" from the American currency, there's been a large public outcry, and they've never successfully been able to do this. However, interestingly enough, this is no anomaly. A desire to put something like this on a currency. Here is a much older coin. I am curious if there's anyone here that recognizes this coin. It's a little bit of a famous one. This is called the Hand of God coin. And I should just mention, I have both of these coins up here. These are pictures I took on my table. I have the coins here with me today that I'd be happy to let you look at and afterwards. This is actually a coin from the Roman Empire, and Constantine had this coin minted. And so this coin comes from, I think they minted it between 337 and 340. So it's a very old coin, and as far as we know, it's the first coin that has a reference to the Christian God. First Roman coin. There may be other currencies out there that we don't know about, but the first distinct one, which is why it's a bit of a famous coin, the Hand of God coin. And if you can look closely, you will see a reference to God on this coin. You have Constantine here. It's a little hard to see on here, but he's on a chariot of sorts. And there's this hand sticking down onto the coin, and it is to be the Hand of God. And Constantine is reaching up to the Hand of God there. And, of course, if you know your history, Constantine is the first Roman Empire to push for a secular movement towards Christianity and a trust in God there. Now, let's just pause for a second and think about these. It's ironic that our coinage, our currency here in America, has "In God We Trust" written on it, particularly since it's very easy to put our trust in the currency, in the money. And I thought to myself, what would be different about our world if we truly lived by these words every time we handled the currency? Every time we pulled it out of our pocket, we reminded ourselves that our trust is not actually in this money. Our trust is in God. And if each person actually implemented that in their handling and usage of the currency, how our world would be different. And I wonder. I also think this demonstrates the weakness of mottos and labels. That is that we can put them on things and quickly forget what it's about or just simply ignore them. I'd be the first to confess that every time I pull a dollar bill out of my pocket, I don't think much about trusting in God. In fact, ironically, I generally am pushed to think about trusting more in God when I don't have money. Which is just kind of an interesting irony. And I could tell you stories about that, and I'm sure many of you could as well. So I understand the weaknesses and the shortcomings of mottos and labels, that is a real thing. But there is also a place to define and have a sense for what something is about and to put some labels on that to give us some reminders and definitions to what we are about and what we are doing. And so while I understand that we live in an era where labels are, I think, largely rejected, and I think, you know, and I think about my generation, sometimes just because something is a label, we reject it. And so we live in a time that understands well the weaknesses of mottos and labels, but I want to think a bit about what they can do for us and where some definition can actually be helpful. You know, my wife has actually taught me some about the value of labels. I'm a very unorganized person, and if I had a drawer to myself, which she's learned it's best if I just don't have a drawer to myself, but if I had a drawer to myself, it would have a lot of things in it that have nothing to do with each other. And she's really good at organizing things and labeling drawers, so we understand where you'll find item X. You can actually predict where it will be. And there's some helpful pieces of this. So I've learned some things about labels from my wife, for that matter. And I would like to give you three things I think labels can do for us. Maybe a healthy way to use them. And obviously, I'm not going to try to be tricky or sly about where I'm headed with this. I want to talk about the label Christian education. That's where we're going with this and what it can do for us. It cannot make us Christian in and of itself. However, it can actually bring definition to what we do. And I want to think about some ways it can do that. So first off, a label can put common language to shared values. It can also organize more complex systems of thought. And thirdly, it can function as a reminder. So I'm submitting to you that we can get caught up in labels and mottos and over-fascinated with our little quips and sayings and just completely ignore them and forget them. But there is also a place for them to give us some definition, to organize things for us and to remind us of some things. And they can do that. I was just on a hike here last weekend. We went backpacking, and I took my five-year-old son with me, and he had not really been backpacking before. And we were covering quite some distance over some rough terrain, and I'm a really intense person. So when I do things, I do them hard. And I found myself getting frustrated with him on the trip because he was getting upset with how difficult the terrain was and starting to fuss about it. And he was wondering why there couldn't be gravel lanes out in the mountains or maybe even blacktop, I think he mentioned at one point. And I was feeling really, really disappointed because I thought, you know, he should really be appreciating the wonderful aspects of a backpacking hike over hills and streams and routes and those kinds of things. And as he got upset, his morale began to dip, and he kept tripping. He'd trip over roots, and when he would fall and hit his knee, then it would spiral into chaos for a bit, you know. And so I was trying to think about how to help him manage his way and actually enjoy a backpacking trip. And I wasn't sure how to talk about it with him, and so I tried to explain to him that the more he fusses, the more he seems to trip. And the more upset and disdain he has for hiking, the more he seems to fail and not enjoy it. But I don't think he was really understanding that whole conversation. It was partly because I was frustrated, partly because it was just over his head. And then we struck on some labels or some terminologies that worked. I discovered that he understood what happy feet and sad feet are. And we began a conversation using those terms to bring definition to the hike that we were having. And he did make sense out of the fact that when his feet are happy, he doesn't trip as often. And when his feet are sad, he tends to trip more often on the routes that are in front of him. We developed some labels that actually brought some language to what we were talking about, organized some complex systems of thought that I waded into initially that were just too complex for him. That he was able to understand, And I also could use it as a reminder when he began to pout and it was getting a little heavy, I'd say, remember, happy feet, Colin. And he knew what I meant. It was a reminder that could bring us back to what we were about and what we were had been talking about. So I submit to you that while there are weaknesses to our mottos and labels as the motto on our currency where you can use it day in and day out and just simply forget it's there, they can do some things for us. They can bring definition to what we're about. They can actually remind us of things that we care about. And so I would like to look at some of the, I'm using mottos and labels pretty loosely here. They're not the same thing, but I'm using them somewhat interchangeably here. I would like to look at some of the defining labels for Christian education. I did something this summer that I found interesting. I spent some time browsing mission statements and websites of Christian schools looking for the labels that define what they're about. And I made a bit of a list of some of the things that I found. And this list is not comprehensive. I'm sure there are more that ought to be on here, and you could add to the list, I'm sure. Now, I browsed schools that defined themselves as Christian, ranging from conservative Mennonite schools all the way to mainstream Protestant Christian schools. So, schools that label themselves as Christian and doing a Christian education, how are they defining that? Oh, in what ways do they say that this thing is distinctly Christian? So, a few of the things that I found. First off, I discovered that we are incredibly centered people. Super centered. In fact, we're just plumb centered. We're biblically centered. We're God-centered, family-centered, church-centered, and child-centered. Not bad terms. I'm not sure if we always know what we mean by those terms, but they are labels that describe and define something that we believe is Christian about what we're doing. I also found that we're extensions of the church and extensions of the family. We also value serving. We serve the church, serve the family. And there were other things that I noticed that are mentioned as being served. I've came across this label fairly often. We strive for excellence. Create lovers of God. Integrated academics popped up numerous times. This one is interesting to me. And I think I'm still trying to fully understand this idea. And so I'm going to give you my best description of what I think we mean by this. Or maybe it's a better description of what we practically do over what we mean. I'm not sure. But this one popped up, and I've heard others talk about this idea, and so I find it somewhat interesting. And from what I can tell, integrated academics means, and this is maybe a more cynical view of it, but that we will teach your child the facts that they would for sure get anywhere else. If they went to a, you know, highfalutin secular school, we've got those facts here. But we offer that to your child, but we also reference God as many times as possible along the way. So it's kind of like this idea of integrating God into academics. I thought to myself, I wonder what this might feel like to God to be integrated into himself, or the need to be integrated into himself and what is true about him. So I'm still untangling that one a bit. But I ask the question, so what does distinctly make an education Christian? We have a list of things here that I find in our literature that put some definition to that. So the label or the term, the motto, however you want to think of it, and I don't think this is just one of those things, but this is the the label that I would like to look at over the next several days. Christian education, what is it? And how would we define it? And if I had the time, I would like to give you a little assignment right now, but I'm not going to have the time to do that. The assignment would be, I would like to give you a few minutes to see if you could write out a bit of a definition for what you think makes an education Christian without using any of the terms on the left-hand side of the screen. I heard one teacher say that haze at the conceptual level is thick fog at the practical level. And if you've taught for very long, you know about that, especially if you've taught math. When it's hazy at the conceptual level, when the student gets down to working it out on their own paper, it is thick fog. And this is a reality for us. Could we put some definition to Christian education without the help of the labels that maybe we're not even sure what they mean? Could we do that? And I intend to help us and inspire us to do a bit of that this week. So we have labels from Christian education. We also have defining labels from secular education. And that isn't gonna, that's not the goal of the topic here this week, so I'm not gonna spend much time on that. But I do want us to think about that for a bit. This is a quote from a book that I read this summer called Old School, New Clothes. And I'll reference that again maybe a bit later. And the quote says, "The problem plaguing modern Christian education in the American evangelical community in general is that unbiblical ideas that govern academia and American culture as a whole have been largely accepted by them, and they are now significantly immune to detecting those unbiblical patterns of thought." So essentially, it's actually possible to have a Christian education that is largely just simply being defined by secular labels and simply be unaware of the ways in which that is happening. Once again, I didn't do the research to know what are the labels that define education, say, versus Christian education. I would wager we could throw some like opportunity, prestige, I don't know. I haven't done the work there. But to recognize that those things, those labels also exist. So Christian education, I ask you, what is fundamentally different each morning that you step into the classroom because you're doing Christian education versus just doing education? What is fundamentally different each morning? Who has a job and who doesn't have a job as a result of this? How easily could you discern a Christian from a non-Christian lesson plan or a curriculum or a textbook if we took the Christian words and phrases out? Is there anything fundamentally different about it? Would you know that it's Christian without those labels and phrases? And ultimately, back to my question that I find myself wrestling with, why would I send my son to you in your school versus to Mr. Drake down the road here at the local public school? And just so you know, I know Mr. Drake. I play basketball with boys from town every Thursday night, and they're all from the local community, and so I've gotten in the habit of asking them, hey, who is your favorite teacher over the years? Mr. Drake's name has come up over and over and over again. I've sat in his classroom. He is an excellent teacher. I think he's a Christian. I'd really ought to just flat out ask him that sometime. He's good at cloaking that in the public school setting. He's a great teacher. Why would I send my son to you rather than to Mr. Drake down here at Maplewood Public High School? I'd like to submit to you four bits of defining elements to Christian education. And this is scratching the surface. I hope that you do work for yourself and your school that goes beyond this. This is just a beginning. These are a few ideas to get us thinking about definition. One, I'm going to give a quote and then a bit of a summary. All educational pursuits reveal humans as either their own end or as subservient to someone or something greater than themselves. As a result, all educational pursuits are religious, theological in nature. We either make ourselves the God we worship or we serve, or we worship the triune God of Scripture. So one of the first bits that I think defines an education as distinctly Christian is the worship that happens there. And I think we ought to have schools that pay close attention to what is being worshiped. What are we giving worth to? Frankly, I think we ought to be leading our students in worship at school. We'll talk more practically about that later. Secondly, all human reasoning is an exercise in interpretation, and this has never been done without faith commitments. Therefore, it is not biblical to think that reason takes us to a certain epistemological point and then faith kicks in. All human reasoning is filled with faith commitments. One of the things that I think is a defining point of Christian education is how we think about thinking. Let me explain just a bit. How does one win an argument? Most of the time, what we call good thinking, and I think essentially what we are taught, is that good thinking is thinking that removes the need for any faith. There's empirical evidence that I am correct. And if my argument requires faith, then our world often describes that as bad thinking. I think we need to redefine what good thinking is. Christian educators, I think, will teach that good thinking is a faith. It does involve faith commitments, and it embraces good faith. We're going to talk later about something I call good faith, bad faith. Let that go for now. But it is a different way, a different description of what good thinking is. It actually embraces faith. Thirdly, non-Christian epistemologies lack the means to evaluate and judge competing knowledge claims. Non-Christian educational pursuits degenerate into some form of socialistic pragmatism or privatized self-interest. Ultimately, the question of authority. My father has done far more thinking on this than I have. I know the question he's often talked about is, well, who says so? This is a defining point if an education is going to be distinctly Christian, and that is, by what authority is something true? And I think this is well said, because when you remove a higher authority from educational pursuits, you essentially, level the threshold off at human ability in that case. And so I agree with the quote that non-Christian educational pursuits maybe generally degenerate into some form of, well, what works for us socially, or what is in my best interest, because there is not a higher authority over that educational pursuit. And the fourth thing I'll submit to you is God has ordained that he would be accessed primarily through a written text that can be read silently or out loud and verbally proclaimed. Reading and listening are emphasized by God as vitally important activities in our fulfillment as humans and our redemption from sin. I'm not even a literature teacher. I'm not a first grade reading teacher. I'm not any of those things. And I think a Christian education is going to emphasize reading and listening. And in part because God has ordained that that is one of the primary ways that we actually access him. Howbeit, not the only way, absolutely, there's other forms of revelation, and of course, we understand we live in community and many things like that. I do think it would be a travesty for a Christian education not to teach these two things. As I said, this is just the beginning. I think that there's far more work to be done here, but along with the labels that I found as I perused our mission statements and websites, I would like to add a few things, a value on the worship that is happening. Good thinking is a faith commitment. By the way, it changes the way people argue with each other when you go here. Christian education is under a higher authority, and reading and listening are vitally important activities. I want to end this session with two stories to illustrate a bit of this, of the question, what is distinctly Christian about what we do? The first story is associated with a photograph that you may have seen before. I'm curious how many of you have seen this photograph. This photograph is a picture of some Amish children, frankly, making a run for it, heading for the cornfield. The funny thing is, as a teacher, I've felt like doing this many times. But this takes place in Iowa, Hazleton, Iowa, Hickory Grove Amish School. I'm calling it the Amish School incident. I don't know if that's the best way to describe it. 1965. Just quick background to the story. In 1947, in Iowa, they were working at closing all of the one-room schoolhouses, religious and non-religious. You know, previously, you would have had a lot of that was the way education was done. And they were moving towards consolidation of education and creating public schools and these types of things. So they were closing down all of the one-room schoolhouses in 1947. Two remained open, and they were two Amish schools. And they remained open with no support from taxes. So once again, how as to what level the state gave permission to that, I'm not sure. But they didn't want to move into the consolidated schools, and so they remained open and supported themselves. However, one of the things that soon arose was the state was not so certain about the quality of the education because they said, well, your children are not being taught by certified teachers. And we're not sure about that. So they put pressure on these Amish schools to use certified teachers. And my understanding was that there was a variety of capitulation. There were some Amish schools actually accepted a certified teacher by the state to come into their school and teach. Others said, nope, we don't want to do that. In 1962... eight Amish men were jailed because they refused to send their children to a school with a certified teacher. So when I say jailed, I think for like 3 days, a short jail service. And then they were going to be fined, I believe, like $5 a day after that until their child was in a school with a certified, state-certified teacher. Well, they were not ready to do this. So the conflict built up there in Iowa. Until November 18, 1965, the state essentially issued that they will be shut down and they will go to the local public schools. And so they put a message out to the Amish parents, I guess. I'm not sure how they did that. And they said, tomorrow morning, there will be a school bus coming to pick your children up. And your children will get on the school bus and they will go to the local public school. So this picture comes from that moment and that crisis. So I guess they met at the schoolhouse, and this is my understanding of it. There's a variety of reports. But the bus showed up at the schoolhouse there. The superintendent was along, and he essentially tried to say, you must get on the school bus. You're going to school today. And no one's really sure who said this, but I might need one of you Dutch speakers to help me out here. Lauf. Someone say run. How do you say run in Dutch? Is that... The way it's recorded in the history books is lauf. I don't know. Apparently, it means run. And so they ran, and there happened to be a reporter there who took a picture of these young scholars running for the cornfield. Interesting note: the superintendent that oversaw that, his name was Arthur Sensor. Struggle on for a while. They ran out of court, some things, local courts. And interestingly enough, he may be dead now, but a few years ago, he was in his upper 90s. I think the article I was reading was from 2012, so it's more than a few years ago. In his upper 90s, and he said, you know, looking back, I would do things very differently than what I did. He said, I did not understand who the Amish were. He said, now I realize that if I would have told some of those men, your child will go to school with me today or I'll shoot you, he said, I now realize some of them would have said, shoot me. He said, I understand the Amish in a way that I didn't before, and if I could go back and do that differently, I would. Story number two, Wisconsin versus Yoder. So this is a bit later. So 1965, we have the Hickory Grove Amish School incident. This is 1971. Quick summary of this is this was based less on, it was still about compulsory school attendance, but it had more to do with after the eighth grade compulsory school attendance. But then, of course, the court case ballooned into some other things as well. But long story short, several Amish students stopped going to school in, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing right, New Glarus, Wisconsin. And, of course, the state said, you can't quit going to school yet. You're not old enough to do that. And the fathers of these three students said, we can't keep coming to school. And one of the father's names was Jonas Yoder. And as he described it, he said he felt that higher education not only endangered their way of life, he actually went as far to say that he felt like sending his children to the higher education is the terminology, or to public school as they were older, would not only endanger their way of life, he felt it would endanger their salvation. So obviously felt very deeply about this. Well, the local court ruled against Jonas Yoder. However, it was appealed to the state Supreme Court, who ruled in favor of Jonas Yoder, which now you have two courts conflicting with each other, so what do you do about that? In America, you try to get it to the Supreme Court, so that's what happened. It went to the Supreme Court to try to resolve the disagreement between the local courts and the state court. And the Supreme Court ruled, and this is what Wisconsin versus Yoder is, do Amish children need, do they, must they go to high school, essentially? Or do they have the freedom to stay at home after the eighth grade? And so it's largely about compulsory education, compulsory school attendance. And the Supreme Court ruled in favor of Jonas Yoder. It said due to religious freedom, it would actually change the way of life for the Amish. And I'm not sure if they really took into account the salvation part, but they said, we do actually agree that it would change them if they did this, and so we actually rule in favor of their religious freedom to not be compelled to attend public high school. These are just two stories that I think indicate the depth in which we as a faith-based people interact with education. And most of us probably see things a bit different from the Amish folks in these stories, and yet it's an indication of how our depth of faith brings definition to what education will look like and what it will be like and why we care about it. So I'm going to leave you with three questions. What is distinctly Christian about the education that you will take part in offering your students this year? Secondly, what is it about that Christian education that you would be willing to fight for? Are there things that you care about that deeply? Whether I agree or disagree with the position that the Amish folks held here, I have some respect for their willingness to say we care about something so deeply that, in the words of the superintendent, potentially you could shoot me and I would still view things this way. And thirdly, the question that I've been asking myself, is it a trustworthy effort? What is trustworthy about what we're doing? I apologize, a little bit philosophical today. We're going to get more practical in the next few days, so we'll get down to some brass tacks. Jonas, turn the time back over to you.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.